Our next speaker is also had a short. He's from the same department as Brandy works in here on the St. Paul campus, and Carl Rosen is here today. The title of his talk is going to be Strategies for Reducing Nitrate Leaching from Irrigated Potato Production.
Well, thank you very much. This seems to be working okay. And thanks for the invitation. This is an area that I've been working in for about 20 years now, and I can say that there's some rewarding things, but there are a lot of, we've made progress. There's definitely some challenges along the way, as you will soon find out. It's always good following Michael. I know that you're all awake. My job is to try to keep you awake now. So, okay, so what we're going to be talking about today is a little bit background in terms of potato production in Minnesota. I'll give you a little bit of background of how the potato grows, and then get into how, because of the characteristics of that crop, there is this potential for nitrate leaching and how it contributes to some of our problems. As I mentioned, over the past 20 years, we've been doing research and trying to identify best management practices that can reduce some of these losses. We'll get into some of those. And then I'll end with a case study. I know Luke's going to have another case study, but this is kind of a shorter one to kind of give you an idea of some of the challenges that we're kind of up against with growing a crop like potatoes. And then just some general conclusions and where I think we need to go from there. Okay, so where are potatoes produced in Minnesota? Generally, you're going to be looking at potatoes in the central part of the state. These are the glacial outwash soils, very sandy soils. Potatoes respond to water and nitrogen, and the way that you can control those inputs is on a sandy soil. And that's why originally when I came to Minnesota back in the 80s, a lot of potatoes were grown in the Red River Valley, dry land production. You can produce 2 to 3 times as much per acre on a sandy soil with the adequate inputs as you can on dry land soil. So that's where a lot of the potatoes have moved onto these irrigated sandy soils. So if you look at the potato production within the state, looking at about 50,000 acres. It's not a lot. When you consider the agricultural land in Minnesota, millions of acres of corn and beans and other small grain crops, 50,000 acres is fairly small, but they are mainly grown on these vulnerable soils. Okay, it's about 70% used for processing. The main variety grown is Russet Burbank. Okay, it's a variety that's been around for 100 years. You can get fairly high yields. This is about 450,000 pounds to 600,000 pounds per acre. So very productive, very productive. You also have some grown for fresh market. And these are what the red potatoes and some of the russets and whites. The yields are a little lower. They're shorter growing varieties. There are a number of major processing facilities throughout the state. Probably the largest one is up in Park Rapids. And you'll find out a little bit more about that in a later talk. If you look at the value in terms of raw product, this is on a per year basis, $100 million on 50,000 acres. That's pretty good for raw product. And then if you put the processing part on top of that, you can multiply that by about 5 to get the economic impact to the state. So it's an important crop economically. Okay. But as I mentioned, because they are grown on these types of soils, irrigation is essential for optimizing the yield and quality of this crop. Okay, what are the characteristics? Unlike alfalfa, which has a very extensive root zone, potatoes have a relatively shallow root zone. Most of the roots are in the top 12 inches. You will get some roots going down to about 2 feet, but in general, most of the roots are restricted to the top 12 inches. As I mentioned before, the crop is sensitive to stress, nitrogen stress and water stress. So typically, rates of nitrogen applied by growers range anywhere from 160 to 300 pounds of nitrogen per acre. But you do get those yields. If you have a good yield, a lot of that will be taken up. So it's not like all of that's being lost. The crop requires that for their growth, for its growth. And as Michael mentioned, one of the problems is that we have rainfall throughout the growing season. So even though we can schedule water very carefully using various methods, and I'll get into that in just a little bit, you have unpredictable rainfall then following perhaps an irrigation that will then leach the nitrate out. As we know, it's very mobile in the soil. So the water holding capacity of most of these soils is usually about 1 inch in the top foot. So there's not a lot of water holding capacity on top. So these are all very challenging factors to try and resolve. And all of these contribute to this potential for nitrate leaching. Okay. So it's not too surprising, based on some of the work that MDA has done on their nitrate testing clinics. If you look at the areas where potatoes grown, basically a little south of the cities, Dakota County has a fair amount. Then it goes up through the central sand plain of Minnesota and a little bit out in here. But you can see that about 10 to 20% of the wells in this potato growing region are above 10 parts per million nitrate nitrogen. So there is a problem. And many individuals and private well owners, municipalities, have had to take remedial action to deal with it. One thing you'll notice that there are some areas that are higher in nitrate in the southwest and southeast. These are not due to potatoes. They're due to other factors. So we can't blame potatoes on those problems there. But in the central part of the state, that is largely due to irrigated agriculture, and potatoes is one of the rotation crops. Okay, so what have we done? Well, the Groundwater Protection Act passed in Minnesota in 1989. We were tasked with coming up with a nitrogen fertilizer plan. The central tool back at that time was to come up with what we call best management practices. And if we look at them, currently they're voluntary, they're research-based. The focus in this Groundwater Act was for a nitrogen fertilizer use. But you also need to consider all inputs, not just fertilizer. Manure, if that's being used, that's also a factor. In Minnesota, with potatoes, manure is not commonly used on potato rotations, so mainly it's going to be a fertilizer issue. In 2008, we came up, based on the research that I conducted, a number of practices that we considered to be useful for reducing or minimizing the nitrate leaching problem. Do they all work all the time? Yes, no. We'll take a look at some of those. But this is, if you're interested, this is available online through the Extension Service. Okay, so let's take a look at what we did in developing these strategies for nitrate reduction. Probably the key to it is selecting a proper nitrogen rate. Regardless of what you do, if you are too high in nitrogen application, you're going to end up with excess nitrogen in the system, and that's going to be a problem. So the way that you select a realistic rate, you need to understand the variety that you're growing. We have varieties that are shorter season, they're determinant. We also have varieties like Russet Burbank, which is the dominant variety, which is a longer season and indeterminate. The indeterminate varieties tend to require nitrogen at for a longer period of time during the season at generally higher rates. Some varieties are harvested early because you're not so much looking at the yield that you're at the end, you're looking at the market. So if the market for potatoes is very high in July, for some of these fresh market varieties, you'll kill them a little earlier. So you won't need as much nitrogen for those. Yield goal, and that's related to the harvest date in many cases. Previous crop and manure, we talked about that. Those can contribute to nitrogen. And then we also look at whether there's any nitrate nitrogen in the irrigation water. That can also be a problem. So what about, so that's the rate is one thing. The other thing is timing. So you want to try to apply the nitrogen to meet the demands of that crop. And one of the nice things about growing under irrigation is that you have flexibility in application of that nitrogen. You don't have to apply it all at once at the beginning because you can put it on throughout the season in small doses. So split applications is the best management practice for applying soluble nitrogen. We recommend no pre-plant nitrogen except for a small amount at the time of planting. We also, and I'll talk about this in a little bit more detail, use of what we now of what we call controlled release fertilizers. I'm going to hold off on that management practices for just a little bit. Okay. In order to understand what's going on, I thought it would be a good idea to kind of go through the season, let you know how a potato grows. There are five general growth stages. Each one has a different nutrient requirement, and the length of each stage depends on the variety that you're growing. What I'm going to be talking about mainly is for the russet Burbank variety because that's the one that is most widely used. So growth stage one, this is what we call the sprouting stage. You just planted the potato. Seed is going to be the primary source of nutrients. This occurs within about 30 days of planting. When you plant the tuber, each potatoes are clonal, so you're not really planting true seed, you're planting part of a tuber. And it takes about anywhere from 2 to 3 weeks for the shoots to come out of the ground. So during that time, nutrient demand is quite low, as well as water demand. Okay, the next stage is the vegetative growth stage, and this usually occurs between 30 and 55 days after planting. Again, you don't have a lot of biomass. You're getting that root system going. The relative water and nutrient demand at this stage is still low to somewhat moderate. Towards the end of this phase, nutrients are needed in higher quantities. And then we start to get to the stage where it's very important to have adequate moisture and adequate nutrients available. This is what we call the tuber initiation and set phase. You're starting to fill in the rows. You start getting tubers being formed, set and formed, very sensitive to nutrient supply. And this usually occurs 50 to 70 days after planting. And then the vegetative growth is going to increase almost exponentially during this particular growing phase. And this is where water and nutrient demand tends to be in that high range. Okay, growth stage four, and this is one of our longest phases of growth. This is what we call the tuber bulking phase. So the plants are taking up nutrients, going into the shoots, and then the tubers then are being formed, and then nutrients then are starting to be translocated down. You're getting slow growth with the vegetative growth, and the plant's concentrating on bulking up those tubers. For early planted varieties, this is 60 to 90 days after planting. For some of our later varieties, like russet Burbank, 70 to 110 days after planting. And here, the water and nutrient demand is still relatively high. It's very critical in terms of tuber growth and quality. Then finally, the last stage is tuber maturation. The vines begin to die. Tubers are maturing. nutrients. There's very, very little uptake by the crop at this point, and mostly you're getting retranslocation of nutrients to the tubers, and water and nutrient demand at this stage is relatively low. Okay, so how do we put all that together? We've done some studies. These are done up at the Samplain Research Farm up at Becker, which is an area where a lot of potatoes are grown. This is days after planting. This is nitrogen uptake, percent of nitrogen uptake, and this is the daily accumulation of nitrogen by the crop. And what one thing to note, so this is days after planting, you get your maximum uptake at about tuber initiation, which occurs somewhere around 60 to 65 days after planting. The plant will require around 6 to 7 pounds of nitrogen per acre per day during that period. So it's a very critical time where nitrogen needs to be available to produce that crop. This gives you the amount of nitrogen total in the plant. In general, you're looking at most of the nitrogen being accumulated, and this is in Russet Burbank, by a little over 100 days after planting. So any nitrogen after that time is going to be not very useful if it's applied at that time. You can see that your vine growth nitrogen, the percent of, this is the percent uptake here, maximizes at about 80 days after planting for the vines. And then that nitrogen then in the vines goes down and is retranslocated then to the tuber nitrogen. So this gives you an idea of the nitrogen dynamics within the crop during the season. So you want to try to make that nitrogen available when that crop is being grown. These are just general recommendations that we have come up with for early versus the late maturing varieties. A small amount of the nitrogen goes on at pre-plant or planting. For emergence, we recommend a higher amount for the early maturing varieties, and then we have a final application a little bit later, but nothing after the post-tilling phase for these early maturing varieties. For the late maturing varieties, there's a lot more flexibility. They tend to be indeterminate varieties. They can make up for smaller amounts earlier in the season, and then they can make that up while those tubers are being formed and growing. So there's a little more flexibility with that. So how do we determine what is needed during that growing season? There are a couple of diagnostic tools that have shown to be somewhat useful. Petiole nitrate analysis, and petiole is the stem of the leaf. You discard the leaflets, you send these petioles to a lab, and you can measure nitrate nitrogen in the crop, and that's related then to the nitrogen nutrition of that plant. It has to be at a particular stage. Works well, particularly with the long season indeterminate varieties. We have found that for some of the determinate varieties, the shorter season crops, by the time you get the numbers back, it's too late to do anything. So for the longer season varieties, it seems to work fairly well. And if that nitrate nitrogen level in the petiole drops to a certain level, then there would be a indication to apply some nitrogen through the irrigation system in that case. We've also looked a little bit at in-season soil nitrate testing, sample to the 1 foot depth. We haven't found real good calibrations with soil nitrate because it is fairly mobile in these sandy soils. So you measure it one day and then the next day it's not there. So We have found that there's just wide fluctuations, and it particularly through the season, we haven't found it to be as useful. We're also looking at other ways of measuring nitrogen in the plant. This is a chlorophyll meter. It measures the greenness. This is, again, related to the nitrogen nutrition of the plant, although the greenness can be related to diseases, can be related to other nutrient deficiencies. But for the most part, on these sandy soils, it's mostly related to nitrogen. So this is an area of active research where we're currently looking at to see if we can get something a little more reliable than the petiole nitrate test. But the petiole nitrate test is better than nothing. And this is just the way that petiole nitrate test works. This is the nitrate concentration in the petiole that's measured. This is days after emergence. And based on some of our calibration work, what it's shown is that in this area here, this is considered optimum. If you're down in this range, you would consider applying more nitrogen. If you're up in this range, for sure you don't want to be applying any more nitrogen. So that's the way that this test would be used and interpreted. Okay, let's go back to the nitrogen cycle a little bit. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this, but I'm sure a lot of you already know it. But what we are trying to do with some of our fertilizer applications is minimize the amount of this nitrate actually going down in this direction. We want it to go up here. So is there a way that we can apply that nitrogen and not have it be so soluble and go to that ammonium form, or perhaps even go into that nitrate form so that you can apply it? It's not, if you get a rainfall, it's not all going to be soluble and move through that profile. So that's an area that we've been working on. And one of the ways that you can do that is what's called these enhanced efficiency nitrogen sources. There are a couple ways of doing it. I'm just going to focus a little bit today on the coated ureas. So basically, we're looking at controlled release nitrogen fertilizer forms. And what this means is that you have a physical or chemical barrier to slow down that solubility. Some of the older controlled release fertilizer forms was sulfur-coated urea. These proved not to be very reliable in the release rates. Some of the more newer technology is actually a polymer, little plastic going around the prill of the urea granule. And there is one example that's economically viable. It's called ESN. It's being manufactured by Agrium. This is called environmentally smart nitrogen. It's the only one that can be used economically by potato growers. Controlled release fertilizers, actually the polymer coatings have been around for many, many years, probably 30, 40 years. But anytime you do something to a soluble fertilizer form, you're going to add a cost to it. So that coating is a cost. The folks at Agrium have developed a coating that is a little cheaper than what's been used in the past, and it can be used under more agronomic crop conditions. A lot of the controlled release fertilizers have been used for very, very high value crops. Potatoes are kind of in that gray area, more than corn, but much less than, say, a crop like strawberries or apples or those types of crops on a per acre. So it's a coated urea. The mode of action is that you do have that polymer coating. It prevents direct solubility. And the release then of that nitrogen is going to depend on two things, whether you have adequate moisture, and under irrigated conditions, that's usually not a problem, but temperature. So what's happening is as the soil warms up, you get more crop growth, but then you'll also be getting more nitrogen being released out of the coated urea. So that's kind of the theory behind it. And this just gives you an idea of what's happening. Here's the coated urea product. Water diffuses in. Nitrogen starts diffusing out. And then that goes into the soil and available for uptake. So if you do have leaching rains when that's applied, it's not going to be as much of a problem. So it's a way to help manage nitrogen on some of these sandier soils. We've developed a method to try to follow the release of these this nitrogen source, and one way of doing that is putting that nitrogen in a little plastic mesh bag. We can put it in the row when we apply it, This just shows the nitrogen being put on. Here's the potato tuber. This happens to be at planting, but we've applied it at different times. We've actually found that the best timing for this controlled release fertilizer is a little bit later than planting to minimize the leaching losses. But this shows what happens to the fertilizer over time. The nice thing is you can recover all of those plastic fertilizer prills, coatings rather. And you can see this is right at planting, 63 days after planting, and then 153 days, all of the nitrogen has been released by that time. The other nice thing that we can do is we put a known amount. We weigh out about 3 grams. We put it into that plastic coating. And then we can retrieve them, take them back to the lab, and we can measure then how much is left. And that the amount that's not measured is what we assume has been released into the soil. So we can develop then kind of release curves based on when that nitrogen comes out. This is percent released. This is days after planting. This is nitrogen put on early in the season at planting. Then this is at emergence. And this was another one we put on at emergence, but we put it right on the surface of the soil. And what we found is if you put that urea just on the coated urea on the surface of the soil, there's a delay in release. And so what we found is basically in terms of the nitrogen uptake characteristics of the curve that the release at with the emergence application seems to match that uptake the best. And that's where we recommend putting this type of a fertilizer on now. Let's see. The other thing based on this research is that you want to make sure it's incorporated. Surface applied, you get more unpredictable release. And that will fit in well to their production system. So incorporation is important. Couple of comments. I don't want you to think of polymer-coated urea as a silver bullet, a magic bullet solving all the problems. It's just one tool. There are problems with it. It can work. We have shown it to work. I'm not going to show you all the data on that, but we have shown that these coated ureas can work in terms of leaching. But we have also found that when used under commercial situations, it can damage during handling and application. So if you have maybe a fairly insoluble product, when you get it from the dealer, if you put it through the applicator, as much as 50% of it can be cracked, and then it's not going to be working. So there are things that need to be done there. That's one of the problems. Also, the growers seem to get a false sense of security when using it. Well, I'm using a coated fertilizer. It's not going to leach. And towards later in the season, they might put on some soluble nitrogen. And if you put on too high a rate of even coated urea, you are going to get leaching with it. So again, it's something that needs to be managed properly. I do think that there's some active research going on some of the coating technology, and I think there's some developments that might help us out in the future. Okay, some other recommendations. Again, we talked a little bit about irrigation management. You can only do so well because of the unpredictable rainfalls, but at least if you're managing your irrigation properly, that will help. At least you're not going to be leaching due to your irrigation. It will be due to the rainfall, not the irrigation itself. So we recommend either what's called the checkbook method, where you can do a water balance of the crop, and or using some of these water monitoring devices to make sure that you're not exceeding that water holding capacity of the soil. We talked a little bit in the past about using cover crops. These would be crops that are planted after the potatoes are harvested. This is extremely important for some of the early harvested potatoes, but become less effective for the longer season growing potatoes because there's just not enough growing season left for those cover crops to be effective. Okay. We're also looking at, as I mentioned, russet Burbank's the dominant variety. It's been around for many years. It's productive, but does require a large amount of nitrogen. We are looking at some new varieties that are being produced. However, and one of these is called Alturas. It's one that's being touted as a very nitrogen-efficient variety. And it is somewhat efficient based on some of our work. You can see that if this is the nitrogen rate, this is the yield, and you can see that you maximize your yield somewhere a little less than 200 pounds, whereas russet Burbank is still increasing. This one tends to flatten off. The biggest problem, however, is that the yield potential of Alturas is not as high as russet Burbank. So even though it's efficient in its nitrogen use, the yield potential is lower. So again, there's some things that we need to look at. Maybe there's some other varieties down the line that might be better. But this is definitely an alternative to russet Burbank, but you're probably not going to get the yield that you will with that variety. And then other amendments to increase water holding capacity have been looked at, looking at manure or other organic matter to help try to allow that soil to hold on to more water and so that you don't get that as much leaching. Unfortunately, the economics of this is, again, not that favorable. Okay, very quickly, I want to talk a little bit about this case study in Purim to show you some of the challenges. This is the city of Purim here. Very high density of center pivots. You can see, I don't know how many, I think I counted about 20 of them right around the city. This is one that's very close to the drinking water well, the Gilliman site, and it's believed to be contributing to nitrate contamination in this particular situation. This is some work that we did in cooperation with the Department of Agriculture, where they buried some of these suction tubes near the center part of the pivot. These were down to a 4-foot depth. And periodically, water then was extracted through the growing season. Okay, this is what was found. Okay, this is nitrate nitrogen concentration in the soil water. This is at the 4-foot depth. This is not groundwater, but we assume that if it's down at 4 feet, that's below where you're going to be getting a lot of potato roots. And what we have here is some interesting rotation. So russet Burbank, this was grown in 2000. You can see that relatively high levels of nitrate. Then we put soybeans in. Soybeans, it lowered that level of nitrate between 20 and 40 at the 4-foot depth. Alturas potatoes, again, limited compared to the 250-pound. If you limit that amount of nitrogen that you're putting on, you're going to be limiting the amount that's leaching. So Alturas potatoes work pretty good, but still fairly high if you compare it to drinking water standards. Then the alfalfa came in, and this was a project that Michael actually helped initiate, I think, from the beginning. And you can see that alfalfa, as predicted, did a really good job. You got down to very almost non-detectable levels of nitrate by the third season. But then all of a sudden, we got some problems here. Again, part of it may have been due to that turnover, the getting plants that are turning over, that are dying, and then the stand was getting a little lower. But then in 2007, we actually had winter kills, very open winter, not a lot of snowfall. And so we actually had death of a good part of the field. And you can see that during that 06 winter kill, they did plant some oats there in the spring, but again, it was leaky. And then in 2008, well, they said, well, the alfalfa is not really doing very good. We may as well go back, put some potatoes in. But then this was at a time when we were using that ESN, coated fertilizer, not going to leach. Well, Guess what happened? It leached. And they put a lot of nitrogen on, and part of the reason was that that nitrogen was an excessive rate following an alfalfa crop. So that rate of nitrogen should have been much, much less than what was put on. So regardless of the fact, I don't know how much is actually coming from the fertilizer versus actual nitrogen coming from what was in that alfalfa. And then in 2009, still a very high nitrogen coming out with edible beans. So it's a leaky system, and there are problems with it. And those are some of the things that we need to work on. Okay, so I guess in conclusion, growing potatoes on irrigated sandy soils is a leaky system, and it's a challenge. The BMPs that we have used, if they're followed, help to minimize the problem. But as I mentioned, there's no magic bullet, no silver bullet. You're going to have to use an integrated approach in this. You're going to have to look at all of the factors, not just one single factor. Long-term solution, I think we need to be a little more cognizant of the varieties that we're growing, make sure we know the rate that's needed and when that nitrogen's applied. And then in real vulnerable areas like in that Gilliman site, just don't grow potatoes there anymore. And in fact, that site is not being used for potatoes at this time. In fact, I think it's actually going to be used as a hospital. It's going into urban. So it could be even worse. I don't know. Anyway, that's my last slide. I hope you learn more about potato production. And if you have any questions, I'd be very happy to answer them. Okay, the question was about the coating on these urea prills. The coating is actually a plastic. It does tend to stay in the soil, but it will degrade over time. Once you apply it, the next year you won't be able to see it. It breaks up fairly readily. And it does degrade over time, but it is in the soil, and there have been some studies on even the breakdown products of that. It's basically polyethylene, that animals could eat it. We hope the microbes eat it, because that's the way it gets degraded. I haven't seen that as being a problem of animals, because you want it incorporated. I guess there'd be some gophers that might. I don't know. That's a good question. I don't know. But it hasn't been a problem. I haven't heard that as being a problem. Gilliman site is in Perham, Minnesota. The Gilliman site. It's about 100 to 120 acre pivot. So it's just one pivot. It's the Gilliman site, it's just named for that pivot. Yeah. The inputs are quite high, usually about $2,000. Actually, Luke, are you going to be going in over that? That's going to be another talk. You'll learn more about it, but usually about $2,000 or so. Is it good business? I didn't hear the last part. It's risky. It's very risky. It's not one of these crops that you have any guaranteed income on. It's not there are no federal payments, so it's a very risky crop. Very risky. That could be. We've talked about that. I think McDonald's needs to get involved with some of that. Some of these companies that actually use many of the products need to be aware of this. I think they're aware of it. They've been avoiding that type of thing. But I agree. I think that if we could get McDonald's to become more involved with this, that would be the way to go. Burger King, McDonald's, all of those processing end users. Yes. Yes, yes. It was used as a crop. It was removed. And that's the only way it is going to be really effective. You keep mulching it back in, it's just going to be building it up. So you do want to remove the vegetative growth in order for that to reduce that nitrate. You would agree with that?
Absolutely. And yeah. That's the way you make money.
Yeah.
I mean, you got to have some.
Yeah, I would say up there probably three, maybe. Three up in that one. Okay. The question was, if we compare this to other potato-producing states like Idaho, have there been studies like this? The main advantage that Idaho has is that when they grow potatoes, there's no rainfall, very little rainfall. So they control everything with their irrigation water. They might get a rainfall here and there that messes their season up a little bit, but nothing the way here. So they have a little more control over how much input of water goes into their potato crop. Their limitation is water, though. I mean, they're in a desert, basically. Same with Washington State and Oregon, where a lot of other potatoes are grown. You're basically growing potatoes in a desert. They do, if you go to potato fields there, there is nitrate being accumulated in those soils, so the crops aren't taking it up, and it would be a good place for the alfalfa to remediate those types of soils. It would be a little easier to do because you don't have the, you know, they might get 10, 15 inches the whole year. We can get that in just a couple of months.
Okay.